once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Well, we did that harmoniously.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
Despite our best efforts.
We are quite capable of saying our names when the pressure is right.
Saying it harmoniously, that takes years of practice. So the telephone number to call in here, if you would like to ask us a question or make a comment or have a thought, if today is August 12th, 2017, is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we've been doing this a long time, and we are representatives. We are the principals, whatever that means. Go to the principal's office of a registered investment advisory firm, and both of us are certified. Something or another, and
certifiable at least.
In other words, we're reasonably well educated, reasonably well experienced, and have made
reasonably reasonable,
and have made enough mistakes with investments and in predictions and so on over the years that we're unlike, and we're smart enough to not go back and make the same mistake a second time. Well, at least maybe not a third time. And so we've come a little way since then. We were talking at the end of last hour about some short-term risks in the market. And there are some short-term risks in the market. They're very obvious, and they are very temporary. And that is basically that basically Congress in North Korea. Congress, North Korea, and we might throw in President Trump if he were to overreact to North Korea, but I won't go there. But the issue is those are temporary items, not things to be worried about. So when's the next recession coming? And of course, we don't know. Nobody knows. If we knew, you couldn't afford to ask. But there've been a couple of surveys of economists, and there seems to be pretty much a majority and something approaching a consensus that says, barring some catastrophic event about which none of us are aware, 2 years, maybe three, is what they're looking at of clean sailing going forward. And, man, is that ever showing up in a lot of the data. There's a lot of things from the past we can look at to say, okay, this is what precedes a major bear market. This is what precedes historically a major recession. And we get used to the fact that some of those things are there. Well, they ain't none of them there right now. And that, by the way, one of the indications that we're in a bull market is the fact that there are an abundance of articles written by people who are concerned that there's nothing to be concerned about. It worries them. It bothers them to no end.
How could that be?
Well, I mean, if there's nothing to worry about, obviously we're missing something.
Right. We must be worried about the things that we're not worried about.
And, you know,
it's important. I'm glad to hear that people are worrying. As we've said many times, bull markets climb a wall of worry. Mm-hmm. When the headlines stop being worried, we'll get worried.
And back 10 years ago, at this point, 2007, we were still in a bull market. But the first hedge funds had already failed because they made a bet on mortgage securities that collapsed.
Right.
And then BNP Paribas, which is a bank you may or may not have ever heard of, but it's a big one, said, okay, we aren't accepting any more mortgage bonds from the United States. Well, actually, they should have said also from Spain, which is where they were.
Right. Yeah, they should have looked at their own mortgage bonds and said, whoops.
But they were first in line to say, we think that all these mortgage securities that we have that were issued by Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and a bunch of other people may not really be worth anything. And everybody just scoffed and laughed at them, and the bull market kept running. We don't have any indications like that. I mean, at this point in 2000, we were still in one of the biggest, longest running bull markets in the history of the United States. But if we looked at the price to earnings ratio
in 2000, I think didn't it fall in March of 2000?
Well, we peaked in some things in March, but it was a natural cyclical, the buy and the sell in May and go away. Everybody thought it was just the summer. And they actually, some of the indices hit records in October before they fell. And so we were at the tail end of a bull market. But at that point, you couldn't find anybody who had anything to say that indicated that there was anything but good times ahead. Same thing was true in 2007. There may have been some voices crying in the wilderness someplace, but they certainly weren't getting any coverage. It was all good times are rolling, and it's likely to continue to roll, and what a good deal, and we can all be wealthy and wealth without risk. Matter of fact, there was a book published in 2000 called Wealth Without Risk. None of that's going on right now. None of the warning indicators, that even the ones that people ignore, are going on. The earnings, the key, and we had this last year, we had earnings down, so there was something that was something to be concerned about. Corporate earnings, we got 90% of the S&P 500 has now turned in its earnings for the second quarter. About 76% of the companies beat estimates, and the S&P 500 looks like it's going to have earnings up for the trailing 12 months by 10%. And better yet, their estimates for the next quarter, which, by the way, tend to be very accurate, one quarter ahead, are that they will break the record earnings levels that we're seeing in corporations right now will be broken in the next quarter because they're going to continue to rise into the next quarter. The estimates right now are that there's another 6.4% rise in the quarter. And since 76% of the companies beat earnings last time, they're probably about the same percent will beat earnings again, beat earning estimates again, because the analysts tend to be conservative, which is a good idea. None of the indicators that would say, hey, warning flag, there may be a rough road ahead, there's something wrong. Even if you dig down deep, 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 the indicators are not there that indicate that they would tell us that something bad is about to happen.
There are certain areas.
Long term.
Well, even short term, there's right. some What's certain that? Areas. They're not national. They are local. And that's the pension funds are still struggling. This isn't new. This isn't a thing that we should say, hey, all the pension funds start struggling right now.
But that wouldn't cause the market to fail.
No, what I'm saying is that you were saying there are – we wouldn't have said when a Spanish bank said, hey, look at the mortgages, we wouldn't have said, hey, that's going to cause the market to fail. So what we need to look at is the state of Illinois, their entire pension fund is underfunded by about 70%. Mm-hmm. They're at the 30% mark.
And that will come due in about 10 years.
Well, before we say when it's due, well, let's look at the other stuff that's happening. The United States as a whole, this piece is good, are 92% funded in their pension funds. That's a relatively good number. It's not a great number. They're supposed to be 100% funded. And it's an average across all the 50 states. But Illinois isn't the only one that's holding them down. California's got some trouble. Their trouble is in the underfunded side, not on the side of their pension failing at any time soon. Illinois's got trouble across the board. Puerto Rico has trouble across the board. There are sections of our economy that used to be the powerhouses of our economy that have a lot of decay in them, and that's still being cleaned out. So we could see a small drop based on this, and small being we could hit a bear market, a short-term bear market. I don't see it happening in the next 2 years, though.
But pension failure in Illinois
and Dallas and then a lot of other places.
I mean, they've got the money to pay pensions for the next 10 years. The problem is...
Not in Illinois, they don't.
They don't?
No.
I thought they did for the next 10 years.
No, they've got a budget that they just passed, which is a big deal. The budget doesn't cover the stuff...
No, I'm talking about in the pension fund.
I'll pull up Illinois here.
All the retirees that are supposed to retire in the next few years retired. And they started drawing money out. Their pension fund, I read, would last for about 10 years. But the problem is that all those people who either retire later or retire and stay alive more than 10 years wouldn't have any money, which is pretty bad by anybody's definition. But still, it's not something that is going to rise up and slap us in the face today.
They have $80 billion in assets in Illinois in the pension funds. Right. So, yeah, they could eat into that principal and pay the people right now. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem with that. They have a liability of $199 billion.
But that liability extends off into the next 30 or 40 years.
That liability extends off into the next 20 years, the way the calculations are being done here. So if they spend the money and their funding ratio is dropping, it's down more this year than it was last year. If they continue, what they're doing is they're spending principal. At some point, something's going to give there. At some point, the pensions are going to have trouble.
Sure.
And what we had, and this isn't a new thing, as I was saying, this isn't something that's just popped up. This is a holdover from the Great Recession. This is the reason why General Motors had trouble. It's the reason why a lot of the other large companies had failings, is because their pensions and their health care for retirees was off the chart. Social Security and the state pensions still run on the same models, and they need to be fixed. So rather than we can say there's no problems that we see, I'm recognizing this is a much more long-term problem.
I'm saying this bull market is going to end one day.
Yes.
And the consensus among economists is that the next 2 to 3 years look like clear sailing. They can't find anything in the next 2 to 3 years that's going to cause it to blow up. Whereas in the past, as we've approached the end of a bull market, even though there's a whole lot of things that would indicate that we're at the end of a bull market, one of which is the most obvious to us, is the fact that we hear nobody saying anything bad. Well, nobody being pessimistic, and yet I open up financial publications and I see the majority of the stories are pessimistic and they're unhappy. For example, today, Wall Street Journal, there's a very good article, The Good Earnings Paradox. We just had record earnings reported for the second quarter for the S&P 500.
Right.
We just highest
it's ever been.
And the market didn't go up. It just kind of, well, it went up a little bit, and it's just kind of meandering around in the middle right now. It's consolidating is what they call it. But that caused a lot of people to worry. Why didn't the market go up when we had record earnings? Well, at the end of a bull market, the market goes up when there's not record earnings. When earnings drop and the market goes up. Now, that would be something I would be concerned about. But the fact that the earnings went up and the market didn't meant the price-to-earnings ratio dropped in the S&P 500. And if the S&P 500, very frankly, doesn't go up any more this year, if it just stays right where it is and earnings continue to rise, the market will just simply get less expensive and have greater potential gain into the future. There's no evidence out there of a speculative bubble at this point. There are several short-term crises that could scare the bejibbers out of everybody when they occur, because there's enough of them out there at this point that I'd be surprised if something this year doesn't occur, because the year ends in a 7.
Yeah, I think that's causation is not correlation.
Yeah,
correlation is not causation.
I'm just telling you, good article in Barron's about this. If you go back to 1887 and come forward to today, there has never been in all that time period a year ending in 7 where there wasn't a major correction. Typically, in somewhere between August, September, October time frame, I have no idea why that particular number comes up. It's just like bear markets in years ending in 0. Amazing consistency over time.
I don't know that those are tied to any real pattern. There's nothing in our life, you know, in a 10-year. Well, let's have a bear market in every 10 years at zero.
I don't see any logical connection. I don't at all. I just know that if you go back into the 19th century, it's pretty consistent. And if you come forward into the 20th century, now it may be off 1 year, one way, like 1929, It didn't quite make it. It was in the end of 1929, but it wasn't 1930, but it was close.
Well, yeah, if you doctor the dates a little bit, you could say, give or take 6 days, all market crashes take place on a Monday.
Yeah, well, that's a much bigger deviation.
Give or take, you know, the six-day movement, you know.
But it could be something psychological going on there. I don't know. I just know that it's just one of those things is like productivity in the workplace goes ups and down according to what day of the week it is. But
well, that's true. Monday's not a very productive
and Fridays
day.
Aren't either. So.
Friday's horrible. Wednesday, the hump day. Everybody's like, oh, I hate Wednesday. Well, that's your most productive day. Go do that some more.
Yeah. So that's where we are right now. And by the way, if you are listening, and it is August 12th, 2017, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400 with any comments or thought that you have on much of anything to do with investing or economics. Do not ask us or make any comments about sports teams, because we don't know anything.
I think Tuesday is actually the most productive day.
Tuesday is supposedly the most productive day. So basically we should – well, you and I cancel Mondays. We don't show up for work on Monday.
Does that make Wednesday our most productive day?
I don't know. I think we're probably exceptional because we've been unemployed for so long. I've been unemployed for 35 years.
You're not unemployed. You're employed self-wise. You're working for your clients.
The only difference between self-employment and unemployment is a state of mind.
Yeah, our state of mind is Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that probably is true, too.
You're either that or you're one of those people on the unemployment rolls that's fallen off the rolls because you're no longer even seeking work.
By the way, can we get really geeky here for a minute?
Oh, as if we haven't been. We're talking about the day of the week, give or take six. That's pretty geeky. Go ahead. Continue the theme.
There is a new study out that explains the Dutch disease.
This is the disease that causes you to wear wooden shoes?
No. What happened is in 1977, the term was dubbed or coined by the economist called the Dutch disease, because what happened is in 1959, geologists discovered 2.8 trillion cubic meters of natural gas. Which
did you
at
say
the time,
Cuban meters? Do they
cubic?
Okay,
meters.
I thought they had a different measuring system there.
Which was the largest field in Europe at the time,
mm-hmm.
under the city of Groningen in the Netherlands. And companies,
I think they could call it the Spanish disease. That'd be a better term.
Yeah,
but
it's called the Dutch disease.
It's called the Dutch disease.
And what happened is, drilling companies and gas processing companies and pipeline companies flooded into the Netherlands, which is not flooded into the Netherlands.
Right, because they've got to turn their pumps up extra strong if they're flooding in.
And the Dutch economy shot up, and the Dutch government began to spend lots of money on lots of things, and everybody was going to be really, really happy, and they began to pump a bunch of gas out, and the Dutch economy collapsed. And a lot of studies have been done. 7 years later, the economist coined the term the Dutch disease. And what happens is, and it's going on in Venezuela, let me pronounce that correctly. It has happened in the Middle East, which is actually Southwest Asia now. And that is when there's a lot of natural resource wealth floods in as a percentage of the economy, so that the economy is significantly affected, and the Netherlands wasn't a really big economy at the time, then bad times are almost certain, not almost certain, but very highly probable to follow. Very bad times. It's very much like winning the lottery. There have been a lot of studies on people who've won the lottery and how it has wrecked their lives, and they wind up in utter poverty by the time it's over with. Not everybody, but it happens in many cases. And there's the study that came out from the International Monetary Fund, two papers from the International Monetary Fund said, basically, it came down to something very, very simple, and we saw it happen in the United States, by the way, now that we recognize what it was. Banks only have so much money to loan, and they began to loan the lion's share of their money to the companies that were drilling for and producing and refining and transporting natural gas, and they starved the rest of the economy for capital. So the temporary natural gas explosion, that's another pun, that went on, sucked up all the money, stopped capital investment in the rest of the Netherlands, and people's money flowed into this temporary natural gas boom. And when the boom went away, they had failed to invest. Now, when did that happen in the United States? The Great Recession. What happened is the money in the United States that goes into loans flooded into mortgage securities in various forms and fashion. People who made these loans and repackaged the loans and repackaged the repackaging of the loans made some tremendous amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of money kept flowing into there, but that was a temporary bubble. And when it burst, it wasn't the bursting of the bubble as much as it was the starving of capital to the rest of the economy. Happened
right
in the dot-com boom. Yeah, all the money went into dot-coms.
Right. When the word on the street, whatever, Main Street, Wall Street, whatever street your name of street is, you're going out, you're about, somebody says, hey, I'm buying real estate. It's a great thing to do. Everybody's buying real estate. Let's get these collateralized mortgage obligations. Everybody's doing it. Look how much money is being made here. When the entire focus of the new money coming in, or very close to the entire focus, goes towards that, then we've got a problem. And you mentioned the dot-com boom. It's not just the dot-coms. There were two things that were going on during the dot-com boom. The dot-com boom burst another bubble as well, and that was the index fund bubble.
Which we're getting again.
Yeah, we're getting that again. The majority of money going into the stock market in 1998 and 1999 and 2000 was going into S&P 500 index funds. And we're back there again today. And that is a precursor to a problem in that S&P 500 index funds do not search for better management. They say you're a company that's big enough to be in the S&P 500, therefore we must own part of you based on your size. That is not a good way to run a business, to give money to people simply because they're on the playing field.
And their capitalization weighted, and
right,
therein is a
more
major problem.
More money to the bigger people on the field.
The bigger the participant in the S&P 500, the larger the value of the stock in the market on a given company, the more of your money, if you use an S&P 500 index fund, goes into that company. And it's a self-feeding cycle, because as more money goes into the biggest company gets bigger faster than the other companies. And pretty soon, as happened at the end of during the year 2000, well over half of the S&P 500, I think it ultimately got to 80%, was held by the top five companies, mm-hmm, and their price to earnings ratios were astonishing.
Off the charts.
And if you look at the top five companies in the S&P 500 right now, they're not off the charts, but they're well up there.
Right. This is important to understand, this whole concept of index funds. The Bogle was saying it back in the late 90s and early 2000, that indexes beat the managed funds hands down, any way you want to look at it. That was true at the time for a short period of time. The bubble burst, it stopped being true, and it stopped being true all the way up to about 4 years ago. And now we have a whole series of studies that are coming out that are saying that indexes beat managed position, the managed funds don't beat their benchmark. And there are some issues that I have with those studies, in that the time period that they're looking at is this Goldilocks period that we've been in for the last 4 years. If you look back, 4 years, we had a correction in 2014 and another one in 2015. They were very orderly. They were not massive single day movements up or down. They were these orderly corrections as the market slowly moved down over a period of a month and then came back up over the period of 3 or 4 months afterwards. These are not the times that managed money shines. It's a time when you can look at an index and say the average seems to be doing pretty well. Why would I do otherwise? And the reason is because when things go weird, when the market starts acting irrational, like it does on a regular basis, that's when a manager should be shining. If that's when you look at a manager, you want to measure them against other periods where they should have been shining, not in the period where the average is nice, but in the period when the average is not nice. And that's kind of a key there. When the majority of people are putting their money into index positions, there's two reasons for that. One is it's a simple answer, do it. The other is that a lot of 401ks, that's all they have. They have a lot of index positions because they don't want to be in a place where they are dinged for having a manager that fails later. It's a safer role for them to say, here is a bunch of indexes. Keep that in mind. What we said just a minute ago about it's not a good management technique to just buy the bigger because they're bigger. Looking at profitability, and it's really easy to make that decision right now when we've got record profits in the S&P 500. When we've got record earnings, record profits coming in, all-time records, it's really easy just to say everything's good. And it is, but there's still some pretty nasty stuff out there.
Well, there's an example. The largest company in the S&P 500 by capitalization is Apple. It has a price-earnings ratio of about 15.34, which is low.
It's pretty low.
Very comfortable. However, if you slide down a couple of stocks, you see that one of the top three is Amazon.
Right. We'll check the price-to-earnings ratio on that.
511.06. In other words, Amazon at its current earnings, it would take 511 years to pay for the stock. Now, that's speculation. And when you have...
speculating that they will have better earnings in the future. That's the idea behind it. We love Amazon. Don't get us wrong. Amazon's a great place. But
Amazon may
511 years is a long time to wait for your money back.
And so that's speculative. That is the kind of investing that Warren Buffett probably wouldn't do. When you look at the price earnings ratios of the top stocks, and you'd realize they keep going up.
And it's not just the top ones. There's other areas that you can look at right now. Basically, if you look at any semi-major down to minor fracking company, you're going to see price-to-earnings ratios in the multiple hundreds. And what that means is that the price of the stock to be paid for in today's earnings would take a certain number of years. And when you've got a 200 or 211 price-to-earnings ratio, based on the fact that fracking is a new technology, and again, don't get me wrong here, I think fracking is a great thing. We have become energy independent. But the opportunity to make large quantities of money on an unknown fracking potential has come and gone. Now people, it's kind of like the movie The Graduate. If you look at the time period that The Graduate was done and the man walks up to him and says, buy plastic, son, or I'm getting the quote mangled there. If you look at what happened to plastic stocks during that time period, The Graduate's supposed to be kind of back in time. It was not a good time to buy plastic. It was when plastic was the byword, like fracking is now, or like the dot-coms were in 2000, when it was already past the point when the money was made there. If everyone is doing it, it's probably not long-term profitable to do that thing, whatever it is. You're seeing the market in its most inefficient, in that the crowd goes to that direction probably because somebody made some money early on. The easiest way to look at that, think of the gold rushes. The 49ers in San Francisco. They found some gold out in the 1849. They found some gold, and about 80 gajillion, and that's the technical number,
I don't think there were 80 gajillion people in the world.
All swarmed to San Francisco and the surrounding areas to go find that gold. Well, that gold, by definition, had already been found. Now, people did find more gold, but not enough to support the 80 gajillion people.
Actually, the people who found the most gold
were the people that set up the bars and the
stores
and Levi the hostleries. Strauss and the, yeah, and what it left was a bunch of people want to go out. They want to feel adventuresome. They want to get invested in the next hot new thing. Well, the next hot new thing isn't the hot thing that everybody's talking about. That's the last hot new thing, not the next one. The next one takes research. So keep that in mind. If it's a name that everybody's talking about right now, and I'm getting a lot of that, people talk about Tesla. Well, I think Tesla's great. I think it's a fantastic idea. I wouldn't buy it. Snap was a big one. People were talking about Snap, and we said, stay away from that. Well, this is one we hit it dead on the head. It was, there's got no profit model. They have a lot of problems with it. Their underwriters stepped back and said, oh, maybe we overvalued them when we took them to market. That's a big statement, by the way. That's a big a mea culpa as an investment bank can say. Facebook is another example, and one where I'm going to make this clear. We were wrong.
Price to earnings ratio 46, by the way, at Facebook.
Right. We were wrong when Facebook came out to say that it's not going to go anywhere. What we said at the time wasn't that, though. And people have, you can, I recommend people go back to look it up. We've got podcasts from the episodes right around Facebook's IPO. Look it up. Look what we, listen to what we said. We said they don't have any kind of earnings model. If you'll recall, they weren't advertising yet. Everything was free. And they've not expanded at the same rate since they put their revenue models in place. And those revenue models are based on some other things. So if you look at what happened to their stock price after the IPO, it plummeted.
Before
it returned back up, now they have a revenue model. They actually have earnings, so they can have a real price to earnings ratio.
Now, Amazon.
I wouldn't buy it still, but
Amazon
that's
actually
me.
Sells something. And yes. They sell it more efficiently than other people do. They haven't found a way to make that particularly profitable, but they keep working on it.
Well, let me be clear here. This is important to know. They have found a way to make that extremely profitable, but they're spending so much money still in creating market share. They're not taking the profit and keeping it. They're immediately turning around with that profit and spending it in ways to outcompete their competitors so that they've got a bigger market share. So and they've been doing that from the beginning. If you look back through their earnings all the way back, they make a lot of money on each of the projects that they start and then turn and spend it immediately on the next big project, which is a problem. At some point, they have to stop doing that. At some point, they have to take the profits.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Amazon, as I was saying, we love Amazon. I buy the vast majority of the things that I buy on Amazon. But until they find a model profitability.
What I was trying to say was that Amazon sells something. They sell some things at a profit. They have a low profit margin on what they sell in general, and they have found a way to have other people sell things and to expand. So I think Amazon has a very high probability of being around a long time.
As do I.
You think you have a probability of being around for a long time?
No, I think Amazon has a probability. I don't know what
Facebook,
my probabilities are.
Facebook, on the other hand, exists to sell advertising. And so Facebook's 46 times earnings. Remember, MySpace was the thing before Facebook. Facebook could continue to be the dominant presence in the whatever market that is. I'm sure there's a name for it. The base place you go on the internet to start going other places. But
your homepage?
I guess. The social communication page that people go to. But I can also see that I myself am using Facebook a lot less than I used to. And the reason I'm using Facebook a lot less than I used to is about one in four posts that show up on my whatever name of the page that I go to see what's going on in the big wide world, my big wide world, is an advertisement. And some of those advertisements are relatively unpleasant to me to see. And I don't want to take the time to tell them why I think it's unpleasant. So I've discovered that I'm going less and less to Facebook. And I've been asking around among other people. And sure enough, they're going less and less to Facebook. Well, that's an indication that Facebook at 46 times earnings might not be the best investment in the world. On the other hand, I am not the millennial person who either uses or doesn't use Facebook. But what I'm trying to say is the top of the market right now, the top five stocks in the S&P 500.
They're getting close to overvalued.
About 12%. There's about 12% of the S&P 500 in the top five stocks. So 1% of the S&P 500 has 12% of the value of the S&P 500. Is that crazy? No. Are the price-earnings ratios up there a little bit weird and a little bit off? Yes, but not excessively so. So what we have is a classic bull market. I would say in its maybe three-quarters of the way through the bull. And that means that there's a lot of room left for it to move up. On the other hand, we could spend a lot of time talking about interest rates. Have we already done commercials?
We have not. Okay,
we probably ought to do commercials.
As we go to commercials, let me talk about this again. Salado Montessori is doing a benefit concert at Barrow Brewing in Salado tomorrow, Sunday, August 13th, between 2 and 8. There's a lot of other good stuff happening in Salado at the time, so I think you should come. I'm going to be there. We have some commercials to play. If you would like to call us, we are the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of these commercials.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is August 12th, 2017, where you are, of course, unless you're military, in which case it would be 12 August 2017, then you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. And comments, questions, thoughts, or whatever about the economy or anything like that.
I have a quick thing to throw in here. There have been some reports that came out this week about inflation area, and it looks like we've got a slow inflationary below the target number. But one piece that I think was really important is there's a report that came out about percentages of executives who report challenges in finding skilled professionals. Okay, so this is two sides of a point that I'm making. The inflation numbers are low, but CFOs are having 62% of CFOs are having trouble finding skilled employees. 61% of CIOs, lawyers, 63%. Advertising and marketing executives, 55%. What that means is that they're going to have to start offering more money. Because now we've got a market that is concentrated, trying to find people to fill spots that they need. They're going to have to start hiring away from other companies. This is kind of a tipping point. We've already seen some wage growth.
And so why haven't they already?
There's a really good reason for that.
I want to hear that.
The really good reason for it is because we haven't really needed the skilled workers up till now. We've been able to retool people that were unemployed from the Great Recession. And this is a great boom that I have not seen much in the way of a media story on. But if you look at the employment numbers and the rise and then stop of rising in college tuition rates, you can see, and enrollment rates, you see a big, if think of a snake swallowing a rabbit, a bunch of unemployed people went back to work or went back to college. They got trained up in a new, highly skilled position that was more skilled than what they had before. And then they hit the market. They didn't hit it all at once. They hit it over a period of 3 or 4 years. There's been this steady stream of new, high-skilled employees with a lot of experience under their belt already coming into the market. And now we're seeing the end of that bulge, because the hiring started in the middle of that, and the people that were in college weren't looking for work, and they're coming out of college. We're at the about the 8 year mark from when the most of the unemployment was.
This is the point where we're I'm waiting to see on this. My attitude is, if they're going to raise the wages offered to a lot of workers, not just a few, because a few won't make any difference in the economy, they're going to have to raise prices to pay for the wages. And
why I started with the inflation numbers.
The question is, at this point, this level of unemployment, normally we see inflation setting in and wages going up. We haven't seen it yet. They may not be able to raise wages in many companies. For example, because of this particular place in the socioeconomic cycle that goes on for a long period of time. I'm not saying this is happening for certain. I'm just saying there's some interesting evidence here. For instance, let's just take one of the bigger industries in the United States, automobile manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
They've been selling cars like hotcakes. They've been making up for missing demand that wasn't there during the recession, and people are finally coming out and they're buying the cars. And then we saw last month, a 6.8% drop in new car sales in the
mm-hmm.
United States.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out this week is, at least part of that, there's a couple of studies that came out, is because of Uber and Lyft.
Yep.
Because of the fact, and I don't think anybody, I can't find any place where anybody in the car industry or the forecasting of the car industry or anything else said Uber and Lyft are going to smash new car sales. I mean, we saw coming down the road that potentially the self-driving car would reduce new car sales because fewer people would need a car. Well, Lyft and Uber are causing fewer people to need a new car.
Right.
And so
in the cities.
Right. And so if you've got at General Motors, they said, we're having a lot of trouble finding skilled workers, but we're not selling as many cars. They can't afford to raise the wages for skilled workers.
Well, here's the deal. In the manufacturing world, we've got less and less workers, period. So the skilled workers at General Motors becomes a smaller and smaller percentage of the total population.
I don't agree with you there. That's a perception. But right now, we have the largest number of people working in manufacturing in the history of the United States.
No.
We don't.
No, we do not. We have the largest.
Not as a percentage. I'm talking about numbers. Absolute numbers.
No, we don't. And we have the largest industrial output, but we don't have the largest number of people working in it as a percentage or in absolute numbers. The industrial output is at the highest level, but we're using less people to do it. It's other service areas that the high-skilled jobs are needed. I mean, we're talking about lawyers and chief information officers and chief financial officers hiring high-skilled people. High-skilled is going from high-skilled manufacturing to high-skilled more on the engineering lawyer side. It's a very different realm of high-skilled, and that's an important factor. When I'm saying General Motors, they're a smaller company than they were 10 years ago. And that's a understatement. They're a much smaller company than they were 10 years ago. Detroit is an example of that. If we look at here's another way. One of the issues with this is that certain portions of the population have had a higher inflation, because there are people that have gotten higher wages than, and this is, we were talking about Amazon earlier. This is a very important factor. There's software out there that helps people find inefficiencies in the retail market. So somebody's walking through Walmart or Walgreens or someplace, and they scan a barcode. It shows on their app that, hey, on Amazon, this is possible to be sold for $5 more. So people at Walgreens or Walmart buy a large quantity at Walgreens, at Walmart, and take it home with them and sell it on Amazon. So some portion of the economy is buying it at that higher price. That's an inflation for that group because they're willing to pay for an extra amount for the convenience of having it delivered. Now, that's slowing down. Part of the high-skilled look is that the chief financial officers are looking for people to look in Walmart and in Walgreens, their own companies, and compare it against what's being sold at Amazon and raise the price to be comparable. So that's happening, which is going to lower some of the wages of the people that are working at Amazon until they find another inefficiency. All of this is in the pot. It's all getting mixed together when we're talking about inflation. It's all getting mixed together when we're talking about employment. It's all getting mixed together when we're talking about wages, because these people that were working at for themselves for Amazon are some of those people that fell off the unemployment numbers because they didn't really get a job from someone else. They're self-employed. And as you said, the only difference between self-employed and unemployed is a state of mind. So,
well, let me go ahead. I'm going to disagree with you on a point. Okay. In 1910, 32.4% of American workers were in manufacturing. There were 8.2 million.
Okay.
In 2015, only 8.7% of workers worked in manufacturing, but there was 12.3 million.
Yeah, but that's not an all-time high. Look back at the 1980s. The 1980s was our all-time high as far as numbers and percentage of population working in industry.
But what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of people working there. Their productivity has gone up phenomenally. And yeah, as a percentage of the population, they're much smaller.
Right.
But we still have a lot of people working in manufacturing. We still have basically something approaching 1 in 10 people who have jobs in the United States are in manufacturing. Because our manufacturing has gone up so phenomenally much since then.
1 in 10 workers, yes.
Right. 1 in 10 workers as opposed to non-workers.
Yes. Yeah,
right.
So there's a perennially unemployed, illiterate group of people between the ages of 0 and 5 that they need to get out and get a job and learn to read immediately.
And right,
they're not even running statistics on literacy numbers in that age group. It's horrible. I tell you,
another pretty good sized chunk of America that is apparently decided that opioids is the way to go, and they're not working either.
I think apparently decided may mean that they were prescribed for an extended period of time and now can't stop.
Right. Or something similar.
Yeah.
And that is definitely an issue in our employment numbers as we have today. The bottom line to it is, though, and this is something to remember, the unemployment rate in Europe, which is our closest competitor in the world, the European Union, with or without Great Britain, is still around 10%. The unemployment rate in the United States, using the same measuring criteria, is 4.3. An important thing to remember is here in the United States, we've had, at least during the last 5 years, and maybe more than that, the healthiest growing economy, major economy in the world. And despite all our thises and thats and the others as we go through this, and I hope you're looking up the 1980s number of people. That
no, I was looking at the unemployment rate for proofreaders.
Oh, okay. but the point is that we have a very, very healthy economy right now. We have corporate earnings that are growing, have been growing for the last year at a 10% a year, and look like they're going to continue to grow. Even a very conservative estimate into the future says 6.4% a year, which is pretty amazing. We have an economy, we have a stock market that is not, it's not perfectly, I mean, I would love to, in many ways, to have a stock market that had a lower price to earnings ratio, but it's a very reasonable price to earnings ratio in the market right now, considering the estimates of future earnings that are out there. And we have interest rates that are astonishingly low, and we could spend some time on that, except we're about to run out of time for this hour on the Personal Wealth Coach. But we are in a Goldilocks economy. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. Yeah, there's a lot of people with a lot of complaints, but we have the least reason to complain of any major economy on the planet right now. Could we be doing things a little better? Yeah, in a lot of areas. There's a lot of stuff around the edges. We're still working on the public school system, trying to figure out why it is not turning out the people that we need in the economy. We definitely have to figure out something that's different in the healthcare system, and whatever it's going to be, it's probably going to be pretty radical. It won't be either going backwards or tinkering with what we have if we're going to make it work. But of all things together, I look around the world and say there's no place I'd rather live than right here. And that's it in a nutshell.
We had a population in 1950 of 161 million.
Roughly
50% of the workers were involved in industry at that point. That was the peak.
In
industrial output manufacturing. That was 50% of the workers, which was about 60 million workers. So about 30 million people were employed there.
Okay.
And so there we are. And we're about out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, call 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach or tpwc.com. Email us directly, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Please come to Salado tomorrow between 2 and 8 for the Montessori benefit at Barrow Brewery.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.